You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
It's Tuesday, April 23rd, and Donald Trump's first criminal trial is underway. We start here. Prosecutors begin giving their case to jurors in the Trump hush money trial.
They're going to try to make this case as much about Michael Cohen as possible.
But if you're still unclear what they're even arguing about, don't worry. You're not the only one. We're going to break this all down for you. Protesters set up camp on college campuses.
They are not going to stop demonstrating until they see some sort of a change.
And now some of these tent cities are being raided. What do you do if a tent is the only home you have?
I would say to them, walk a day in our shoes.
The Supreme Court takes on a case that could reshape your city's policy on homelessness. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Never in American history have we seen this. A former U.S. president sitting before a jury facing criminal charges. But yesterday in New York City, that is precisely what we saw.
Donald, where's Melania?
As loud and circus-like as this has appeared outside,
this is done as election interference. Everybody knows it.
This case inside court has the potential to be kind of wonky and confusing. For instance, it's being called a hush money trial, but the charge isn't so much about hush money to an adult film actress as it is about whether financial records were falsified around those payments.
He puts in an invoice or whatever, a bill, and they pay and they go on a legal expense. I got indicted for that.
And for Donald Trump to be found guilty, prosecutors will have to prove even more than that. Yesterday, this trial got underway. 12 jurors sat in the box, listened to opening statements, and then listened to the people of New York's first witness. ABC's chief legal analyst Dan Abrams is here to break it down. And Dan, I feel like we're all going to be hearing about this every day. I just want to get us all on the same page. So can you help us understand both sides here? First of all, the prosecution, what are they trying to prove to the jury here?
First and foremost, they're trying to convince the jury this is a big deal. That this isn't just about somebody checking the wrong boxes or misfiling. They're talking about this being a criminal conspiracy. And they're explaining exactly how it happened, who was involved. But in the end, that they argue the goal was to protect Donald Trump in the 2016 election, and that that was a crime.
Because because it's not illegal to do a hush money payment, but it is illegal to do it in this way. Is that the gist?
Right. Hush money payment in and of itself is not illegal. That's what the defense hopes the jury takes away from this, which is, wait a sec, what? This was a hush money payment and it's not even illegal? No, no. Prosecutors are saying it's not about the payment. It's about the way you lied in your business records about what happened, and that the goal in doing that was to violate election law. And that's a critical piece of this, because if it's just about the records and the falsification of records, that's a misdemeanor.
Right.
To get you to the felony, which is what they're charging here, you need to be able to show that it was in an effort to conceal or commit another crime.
And that's what I find so interesting, because early on, when this case was announced, legal analysts had said, like, this case sounds a little wobbly because, like you said, falsification of business records like this would usually be a misdemeanor unless you're breaking what, like, federal campaign finance laws. Is that what the prosecution has to prove, that this has all been in service of, like, do they have to prove that a federal law was broken to prove this case?
No, but here's why people were critical of Alvin Bragg early on, was because he didn't identify what was the crime. What is the bigger picture here? Why is this a felony? He just wasn't laying it out. Yesterday, we saw this laid out in more concrete terms, that this was all a criminal conspiracy to protect Donald Trump in the 2016 election. We already know that the first witness who testified yesterday, David Pecker, is going to be the centerpiece of this. That's why he's the first witness, because They're basically saying that David Pecker and Donald Trump and Michael Cohen created this agreement that would prevent any negative stories about Donald Trump from coming out because they wanted to protect him in the election. And David Pecker was the heart of it.
And at the time, he's the head of AMI and the head of the Inquirer, all that stuff.
Correct. So he, they argue, is at the center of all of this. He becomes a critical witness. He just began his testimony. So we'll have to see exactly what more comes from David Pecker. But that's the key from the prosecution's perspective to the conspiracy.
Well, and so the defense, the Trump team, I mean, what are they going to argue? They don't need to argue he never paid hush money, right? Like, he's actually kind of said many things about whether any of this is true, but it doesn't matter if he paid hush money. So what do they respond with?
The defense is really saying two things. Number one, they're saying Donald Trump didn't even falsify business records. He was just relying on other people like Michael Cohen.
Here is the truth. The people of the United States of America, the people of the world, don't believe what he's saying. The man doesn't tell the truth. And it's sad that I should take responsibility for his dirty deeds.
But secondly, they're going to try to make this case as much about Michael Cohen as possible. Mm. The defense wants these jurors to be thinking about Michael Cohen's credibility. The prosecutors are saying, yes, Michael Cohen's a witness for us, but we can corroborate everything that he's saying. So a big picture, two-prong argument, one being he didn't even really do the falsification of the business records himself. And second, Michael Cohen is the linchpin here and you can't believe him.
How do you handicap this, Dan? Do you have thoughts on how this might eventually turn out based on what you've heard so far?
Look, I think this is going to end up being a hung jury. Hmm. I think you're going to have people who were more anti-Trump than they suggested who ended up on the jury, and they're people who are more pro-Trump than they suggested on the jury. And you just need one person to hang the jury.
Right.
So if you get a single person who is going to say, you know, I can't convict on this crime, this nothing case. Because remember, it's not for the jury to decide should the case have been brought. It's not for the jury to decide motivations behind the prosecution. It's for the jury to decide, does the evidence here reach that level beyond a reasonable doubt? But if you get jurors who do decide that the other questions matter to them, even though they minimized it in jury selection, that's where you could get into trouble for the prosecutors.
Wait, are you saying it's because jurors basically, this is kind of an exciting case, to be honest, so you sort of hide your true feelings, or that they come into play because we're humans and we can't help it?
Well, or more shades, a little more of shade of gray, which is to say, I think I can be fair, yeah. Mm. But now that you start presenting the case, oh, come on, really? Mm. We're here over hush money payments? Again, that's something that goes into whether he should have been prosecuted. That's not a question the jurors should be assessing in, is he guilty of the crime? But they still may.
Yeah, and of course, a lot more now as witnesses, some of these very well-known witnesses start coming to the stand. Dan Abrams, our chief legal analyst, thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Next up on Start Here, the defining piece of protest equipment is no longer a sign, it's a tent. Why schools are closing their gates over Gaza after the break. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here. The war in Gaza has razed cities across the 25-mile-long Gaza Strip. But here in the U.S., the epicenter for debate over this war has increasingly been on college campuses. Free Palestine! For months, that tension has been bubbling. But right now, it's boiling over.
Let them go! Let them go!
There are several potential reasons for this. It could be events on the ground in the Mideast, with Israel contemplating an incursion into Rafah. It could be the end of Ramadan, leaving many Muslim American students more able to engage 24/7. It could also be because at Ivy League schools like Columbia, university presidents have been called before Congress to address concerns about anti-Semitism on campus. Well, whatever it is, in the last week or so, this has boiled over to the point where police have been called into Columbia, Harvard, and Yale to make arrests. In fact, yesterday, Columbia announced it's no longer holding in-person classes because of the risks, perhaps, to student safety. All of that just as Passover was about to get underway last night. ABC Stephanie Ramos traveled to the Columbia campus. Stephanie, first of all, what is it like out there?
So there's definitely this ongoing friction between not just two sides, but multiple sides, multiple groups that are not seeing eye to eye, are not agreeing on these topics. There's tension throughout the campus. There's tension from the pro-Palestinian demonstrators, also the pro-Israel demonstrators that showed up.
From what river? From what sea?
And we're right there alongside the other demonstrators outside the Columbia University gates. It's been nonstop.
Hey, can you kind of just help us understand how this all started? Because it really seemed to kind of escalate last week and going into the weekend.
It did. So April 17th, that's when student protesters opposed to Israel's war in Gaza camped out throughout the Columbia University campus. And they're allowed to do that. They're students there. Columbia University Apartheid Divest, it's a coalition of more than 100 student groups. And they say that they are calling for the university to financially divest from companies and institutions that profit from Israeli apartheid, genocide, and occupation in Palestine. I spoke with the spokesperson for this group, and he stressed that they don't want conflict, they don't want chaos on campus, but they do want their voices heard, and they are not going to stop demonstrating until they see some sort of a change, some sort of agreement from the university. Columbia University called police last week. They arrested at least 100 people. But that did not deter students. Students put up more tents over the weekend. And the response also brought pro-Palestinian demonstrators who were unaffiliated with the school to the school. So in the last couple of days, the demonstrations have not slowed down and they have not stopped. And this all comes after the Columbia University president, Manoush Shafiq, spoke on Capitol Hill.
Safety is paramount and we would do whatever is necessary to ensure the safety of our campus.
Many demonstrators upset with her remarks and her comments about the situation.
The mass arrests and the suppression of students, I would say that's galvanized us.
So many of those students that were arrested, by the way, have been suspended for taking part in these protests. I spoke with a Columbia University PhD student. She said she was peacefully demonstrating.
And then the NYPD came in and arrested us one by one immediately. zip-tied us with our hands behind our backs.
And was arrested, and she found out the very next day that she has been suspended indefinitely. She's hoping that that is revoked.
I personally am the granddaughter of a Holocaust survivor, and that's why I'm here, is because when we say never again, we should mean never again for any people.
But she just expressed to me that they are peacefully protesting. She says they are isolated incidents from other groups. But as far as the student demonstrators who are on campus, allowed to camp out on campus, are just trying to make a difference.
Hey, and when it comes to the cancellation of classes, is the rationale there about, I mean, what is the rationale? Is it more about just taking a breath, or is it about student safety?
Yes. So the Columbia University president defined this as a reset and also made a reference to students not feeling safe on campus. We heard from Jewish students about this.
I'm trying not to go to campus just because of how, you know, I was there today and it made me sick hearing the things they were saying and doing.
There was one young woman that I spoke with. She's actually a freshman at Columbia University. And she was telling me how she was with her friends, her Jewish friends. They were on campus and they were singing and were approached by what appeared to be a pro-Palestinian demonstrator who held up a sign near her that was referring to the Hamas military wing and basically saying they were next.
They wanted violence, and they stood there with that sign saying they wanted Hamas to attack us, essentially.
And that frightened her, as it would frighten anyone. But she was telling me just how she doesn't feel safe going onto campus because that is taking place.
Violence has no place on this movement, and we regret some of the incidents that has happened that were actually unassociated with this movement.
Despite hearing from pro-Palestinian demonstrators who say, we just want to be a voice for the people in Gaza, you still have other individuals who are taking advantage of the situation, you could say, and either committing acts of violence or acts of intimidation toward the Jewish student population there at that university and others across the country.
Yeah, Stephanie, talk a little bit more about this protest encampment idea that you got, 100 tents sitting on the quad. It sounds like that's not just Columbia either. Is this becoming the norm at maybe other schools as well?
It appears to be. We know that there are students who are planning to demonstrate and hold encampments like what we've seen at Columbia University, at MIT, at Tufts, and we saw that at Yale on Monday as well. At least 47 people were arrested during a protest in support of the Palestinian people. So we are continuing to see this. Again, this is at Columbia University. The president was trying to reset as the in-person classes were canceled, but it seems to be an ongoing situation, not just at Columbia University, but at universities and colleges across the country.
Yeah, and like you said, protests both on campus with students there and protests off campus, which even seem to be more inflammatory there at Columbia right now. Stephanie Ramos, thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Brad.
It's interesting talking about these encampments on college quads because I also feel like there's something about tents springing up where you don't want them. Like, it just feels unnerving sometimes. Like, the rules of a place have taken a break. And this resistance, this discomfort springs up not just when protesters start erecting their tents. It also applies to what have become tent cities in so many urban areas. Well, yesterday, the Supreme Court heard what's become an urgent case on homelessness in this country over cities that are issuing fines to the people least able to pay them. Let's bring in ABC senior Washington reporter Devin Dwyer, who covers the Supreme Court for us. Devin, what is at issue here?
Well, this is a case, Brad, the biggest case on homelessness to reach the Supreme Court in more than 40 years, that asked the question, can cities punish people who are homeless and want to sleep outside on public property? It's an extraordinarily complicated and thorny and emotional question that has gripped the court and communities nationwide.
I say housing, you say no, housing!
No.
Housing.
We've seen record numbers of homeless people, particularly on the West Coast, Brad.
These encampments in California are unacceptable.
And a growing number of cities are turning to laws, to punitive measures, to try to get those people off the streets and incentivize movement towards social resources that exist. And so the justices yesterday were grappling with Is that okay? Can cities issue tickets, citations, possible jail time to homeless people when they have nowhere else to go? A federal appeals court in California last year said that that amounts to cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment. And yesterday, the justices seemed to take a pretty skeptical view of that conclusion about these types of laws.
Well, and we often talk about Los Angeles and San Francisco, but this case actually comes from a smaller town in Oregon called Grants Pass. You went there, right? How did this case sort of rise through the ranks?
Yeah, a tiny town, about 40,000 people. They have a community of 600 homeless residents, and they have no homeless shelters, Brad. We saw dotting the public parks, the Little League field, under the overpass, down by the river. Lots of tent communities, really, of people, many of whom were Grants Pass natives.
They complain about us being out here, but there's no place for us to go.
Who had been priced out of the market, suffered a tragedy in the family, a death.
Losing my husband has flipped my life upside down. And
in some cases, addiction. And they ended up living in the park.
So the city came in and said, you can't camp right there on those wood chips.
The officer said I was too close to the playground and I was too close to the fence.
We met one unhoused gentleman, Brandon, who was in the process of packing up his things and moving it to a different side of the park because the city has an ordinance that anyone who is residing in a public park is homeless, has to move every 72 hours.
He threatened to give me a ticket, you know, and all this crap and everything else.
I would say to them, walk a day in our shoes.
We met Helen Cruz, who is now living in a church nearby, but she told me that she was living in the Little League ballpark for more than 5 years after she couldn't afford her home.
And mind you, I was holding down two jobs when I was out here, and still not enough to be able to rent a place. Their terms of low-income housing here is $1,000 a month.
And the thing, Brad, is that she said that she received more than $5,000 in fines and penalties over the course of her, you know, encampment in the city park over the years. And she said that that was simply cruel.
They're the ones that have the right to be a human, not you, because you don't have your white picket fence.
Kicking someone when they're down, giving her a criminal record, to make it even harder for her to get a job. And if she couldn't afford the $1,000 to pay the rent, how was she going to even pay the fee? And so people like Helen Cruz brought this case and they won in the appeals court level.
For all intents and purposes, a lot of the behavior you see here today is illegal. And then our community will ask, well, what are you doing about it, Chief?
But Brad, when we talk to local officials, local representatives, community leaders, even some residents who look out at some of these encampments, a very different story. And they see what's going on in their community as a matter of public health and public safety.
We've had shootings in our parks. We've had fights in our parks. Chronic drug abuse in our parks.
I met up with Police Chief Hensman in Grants Pass, and he told me that they're hearing from residents who are afraid to go to the parks. At the same time, they're trying to be accommodating and respectful of people that have to live in the parks.
And is it safe to have a kid play in the park where there's a tent 20 feet away? I don't know what the people in the tent are doing.
We talked to Dwayne Yunker, a local representative who sits on the city council, and he said the city council is caught between a rock and a hard place. They're trying to balance interests, and they decided that by passing this sort of ordinance, they would be incentivizing people to move towards the resources that are there.
Even Gavin Newsom, as the governor of California, which is one of the larger states in the United States, he doesn't even know how to deal with this. And you're asking me as a city council or a state rep to how to do this when everybody in the nation is trying to deal with homelessness and what is fair? I think that's the question. What is fair?
Well, and so with these sort of competing interests, I mean, what was the scene yesterday like at the Supreme Court? Could you tell which way the justices were leaning?
Well, the conservative justices, Brad, were across the board, of course, empathetic with those who don't have housing and are struggling in this way. But almost to a T, were very sympathetic to the city of Grants Pass and acknowledging that cities, not courts, need to be the ones dealing with these sorts of issues. We heard Chief Justice John Roberts experts say
many people have mentioned this is a serious policy problem.
Should a city build a new shelter? Should they build affordable housing? Should they replace lead pipes in some cases? Difficult decisions, he said, should be left to local communities.
Why would you think that these nine people are the best people to judge and weigh those policy judgments?
We heard Justice Neil Gorsuch say, where do you draw the line if it's cruel and unusual punishment to say someone can't sleep in a public place? What about defecating?
How about if there are no public bathroom facilities? Do people have an Eighth Amendment right to defecate and urinate outdoors?
No, we...
Is that conduct or is that status?
Are those laws now going to be in question because they'd be seen as cruel and unusual punishment? He certainly didn't think that that would be cruel and unusual punishment. But on the other hand, Brad, the liberal justices were incredibly passionate, saying that homelessness is involuntary.
This is a difficult policy question, Justice Sotomayor. It is.
Where do we put them if every city, every village, every town lacks compassion and passes a law identical to this? Where are they supposed to sleep? Are they supposed to kill themselves not sleeping?
It's an almost immutable quality that people in this situation can't help it, and that by making it a crime, you're in effect criminalizing their status, which is something they said, or suggested at least in their questions, was anathema to the Constitution.
What would be the potential impact of a ruling here? Like, what are the next steps here? Because this seems like it would have just profound implications for so many cities.
Yeah, sweeping implications here, Brad. I mean, this decision will apply to every city in America, potentially. And while it won't solve the problem of homelessness, everybody agrees on that.
Right.
It could, if you're the city of Grants Pass, empower cities to do more to regulate encampments, to get in there and actually try to clean up these places, really encourage homeless people to get to the resources. If you're the homeless community or homeless advocates, you see this in equally as stark terms.
When are you going to get out of this park?
When am I going to get? Probably when they have houses to go to, when they have a place for us to go.
Red cities, blue cities, red states, blue states, they're all on the side of Grants Pass here, and at least needing some tools to address this. But you've got homeless advocates saying, rather than giving somebody a ticket, build an affordable house for people to live in. That would be a better answer. So a fascinating debate, and an emotional debate, but one that really could have an impact at a time when we're seeing record numbers of Americans living on the streets.
Yeah, and I looked it up. I mean, this is not a stretch to say it is worse now than it has been in the past. You're looking at significant percentage increase in homeless populations in many, many American cities, large and small. A decision expected perhaps by late June. Devin Dwyer covering the court. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, what makes lining up for airport security so terrible? One lawmaker says the answer is clear. One last thing is next.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
One last thing. If you fly often, you know the whole experience feels like a lesson in feudal class structure. You got the first class people and the coach people. You got the people who paid extra for legroom or to get on the plane first. Then you've got the middle seat normies. And if there's one place we're all supposed to feel equal, it would be in the security line, where each of us are screened, regardless of our station.
Highly recommend that you remove your shoes.
That is, until you see someone escorted to the front of that line with an airport employee telling the TSA agent in front of you, "Hi, we got a clear customer here."
A clear ambassador will escort you straight to physical screening, and our good friends at TSA will take it from there.
Clear is the service you see at airports, where for $189 a year, you can get pre-screened, then go to a little kiosk where your biometrics are recorded, go to the front of the line, even past those folks who paid for TSA pre-check. Well, yesterday, a California state senator put forward a bill that would ban Clear from California airports. Josh Newman, a Democrat from Southern California, says this is driven by more than an annoyance of being cut in line. It's the sense that government services are for sale. After all, he says, the police work work for all of us. The TSA works for all of us. So why would the TSA be able to prioritize some people ahead of others? Newman says he'd actually be fine with Clear running its own dedicated line the way TSA Pre does, but the fact that everyone else gets put on hold to make sure these VIPs are catered to, he says, strips customers of their dignity. And what's so frustrating about this is that TSA Pre, Clear, all these things, are ostensibly how we do want airports to work for everyone.
Step into the row and allow those behind you to pass.
Right, don't worry about your belt and your shoes. Let technology do the work ahead of time when you book your flight so then you don't have to wait in line as long on the day. But once money is injected into the system, it raises everyone's suspicions. Like, how much is this fee really about safety and how much is about making sure these frequent flyers can spend their way into shorter lines? A union representing TSA workers in Northern California actually came out in support of this bill, saying Clear's aggressive sales pitches in airports, preying on the sense of frustration, makes it a worse experience for non-customers. Airlines who work with Clear say the company helps speed up lines, and a spokesperson for Clear says that while they're always working with state and local officials to improve the customer experience, their product has to date directed $13 million and hundreds of jobs to California airports. The fate of this bill is decidedly unclear, and it's still not a given whether fellow lawmakers will support it, or even what power California holds over TSA procedures. But even if this bill takes a while to snake its way through the legislative line, well, I know the feeling. Now, several years ago, I invested in TSA PreCheck. It's changed my life. It begs the question, though, if your partner doesn't have that, do you go stand in the regular security line with them, or do you say, good luck, I'll meet you at the gate? Because I had to stand with my wife for like two trips, and as much as you love that person, you're like, I don't know if I can do this anymore. Like, I don't know if we're strong enough for this. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.